To mark the launch of the new Spectator app, we're offering our podcast listeners the chance to try a 3-month digital subscription absolutely free. To start your trial, go to spectator.co.uk/app offer. Hurry though, the offer ends on Sunday.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Dennis Staunton, the London editor of the Irish Times. This week, Arlene Foster handed in her resignation as DUP leader and an election is underway. This comes after increasing concern on both sides over the Northern Ireland Protocol between the UK and the EU. James, when it comes to Northern Ireland, it seems as though the situation is getting worse and worse from the unionist perspective. What's going on?
So I think Arlene Foster has essentially been undone by unionist anger at the protocol. Ever since protocol came in, you've seen DUP support falling. There was a Lucid Talk poll, which I think freaked the party out, which showed them down to 19%. The TUV, the more hardline party, up to 10%. And I think Arlene Foster has essentially been removed in the hope that a new leader can appeal to more hardline unionist voters. But I think this is not a simple equation, because if you, for example, one of the people talked about as a potential successor to Arlene Foster is Gavin Robinson, the MP for East Belfast. You know, his seat is in danger, not to the TUV, but to the Alliance Party. And I think if the DUP goes back to, you know, more explicitly evangelical Protestant party, more hard line, then I think it will run into electoral trouble. I think if it majors on its social conservatism, one of the immediate triggers for Arlene Foster's removal was that she abstained in a vote in a ban on gay conversion therapy. Well, most of her MLAs were opposed to the ban outright. Then I think the DUP will lose more support and compound some of the union's kind of generational difficulties. And I think the other factor to worry about here is next year's Stormont elections, I think, could be very destabilising for Northern Ireland in two ways. First of all, the concession that Boris Johnson extracted from the EU was that the Assembly can remove the protocol by a simple majority vote. Normally there are kind of break provisions so that both communities have to be happy with what is being done. I think if things carry on as they are, and certainly, remember, the protocol has not yet been implemented in full. This is very much the diet version of it. You can imagine unionist parties running in a kind of pact saying, you know, let's get a majority and scrap the protocol. That would turn the election into a census and would be hugely destabilising. The second thing that could be destabilising is that this splinter in the unionist vote might allow Sinn Féin to come out as the largest party. And under the St Andrews Agreement changes to the Good Friday Agreement, that would then give Sinn Féin the right to nominate a First Minister. Now, the powers of the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister are the same, but I think the psychological impact on unionists in Northern Ireland of having a Sinn Féin First Minister would be too much, and I find it very hard to believe that power sharing could continue in a situation where the First Minister of Northern Ireland was going to come from Sinn Féin.
Dennis, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think the DUP faces two problems, though it's losing support to the traditional unionist voice on the right, but also losing support to the Alliance on the left, and an increasing number of younger people, especially from the unionist community, are quite prepared to vote for the Alliance Party, even if that means that Sinn Féin emerges as the largest party and that Michelle O'Neill becomes First Minister of Northern Ireland. That bluff which the DUP have been going with for so long, they're prepared to call it. And it's partly because of alienation over the things that James was mentioning to do with social issues, issues like abortion, LGBT rights. But it's also just that it's a sense that this party has ossified, that it's that basically they handled Brexit and the protocol very badly. First of all, simply by embracing Brexit in the first place, they should have seen that it was going to create problems for Northern Ireland. And then by the way in which they handled their negotiations with Theresa May and later Boris Johnson, they ended up with an outcome which was very bad for unionism as far as unionists are concerned. So I think that you're seeing these two problems that they have. And the difficulty is that if they go for somebody like, say, Geoffrey Donaldson or Gavin Robinson, who are closer to ideologically to Arlene Foster, then they probably will continue to lose votes to the right. But if they go for the other, the leading candidate, Edwin Poots, the problem is there that they are more likely to continue this trend of losing younger voters, especially to Alliance.
And James, looking ahead to next year's Stormont election, we're been setting out some of the problems the DUP face. But I suppose more generally, you've written before that this could turn into a proxy referendum on the protocol. What do you mean by that?
Well, because the protocol can be abolished by a simple majority vote of the Assembly, you would have unionist parties saying, vote for us, give us a majority in the Assembly, which they don't currently have, and we can scrap the protocol. Now, electorally, in terms of electoral maths, it is difficult for unionist parties to get a majority in the Assembly, but it is not impossible. If you take the 2017 general election results in Northern Ireland, you transpose them onto the Assembly, you would get pretty close to that. They would be within touching distance of it. And I think this is where the case for compromise comes in. Right now, these grace periods, which the UK has extended unilaterally, mean that we're not feeling the full impact of the protocol. Apply the protocol in full, and I think the prospects of unionist parties, A, trying some kind of pact to scrap the protocol, and B, if not being able to get a majority, being able to get close to that is real. I mean, right now, 48% of people in Northern Ireland want to scrap the protocol already. But this is the problem. 46% of people in Northern Ireland, I think I'm right in saying, want to keep it. It is polarising. I think if it starts cutting into people's lives even more, which it will without compromises, unionist opposition to it will grow because it will become less ideological and more, I'm really irritated, but I can't get something in the supermarket, I can't get this, I can't get that. This protocol is a pain, and you'll see people moving against it. I mean, that is the problem. I think just to pick up from what Dennis said was saying about the alliance issue, there's a fascinating row in Northern Ireland at the moment, which is Gavin Robinson, the wife, is currently in a kind of social media storm because of her positions on abortion and gay conversion therapy. And she's saying, you know, I'm fed up with the misogyny. My views are my views. Back off. And I think this is a fascinating proxy for this debate in Northern Ireland about how can the DUP avoid alienating younger voters and shore up its flank against the TUV. And I think this is, someone said to me that there's a Ian Paisley quote when he said, tens of thousands of Protestants vote for me who've never darkened a church door. And that he always understood that his unionism, his muscular unionism, to put it mildly, was more important electorally than the social conservatism. And if the DUP majors on the social conservatism, I think that will compound the very problem that Dennis was talking about.
And Dennis, when it comes to the protocol, not really even yet seeing the full protocol. There's still various, you know, grace checks that are not being put in place. So do you think the EU will listen to the UK government when it says, no, you've got to keep waiving these things? Or what is the mood like on that side?
I think Maros Sefcovic, who is the Vice President of the European Commission, who negotiates with the British government, with David Frost, on these things, he is sympathetic. He wants to find a solution. The rest of the European Union, the member states, are not particularly interested. They've moved on from Brexit. They've got other things to think about. And I think it's probably a better idea from Britain's point of view not to attract their attention, because their attention generally will tend to be negative. And so what that probably means is that actually a fairly subtle approach to dealing with Sefcovic is probably likely to be more effective in making this protocol work in a way which is better for people in Northern Ireland, which removes some of those irritations that really annoy people in daily life, and that also makes it better for business in Northern Ireland, because the idea from the European point of view with the protocol was that there was a chance that it could be the best of both worlds. But obviously part of its purpose is to protect the European single market, and so it has to do that. The basic fact about the protocol is that it is not going to be replaced. The British government knows it, the European Union knows it, and actually most politicians in Northern Ireland really know it. What the Europeans see, though, when they look at what's happening in Northern Ireland, is that they see a crisis that was fueled by the British government, because the British government fed hopes among some unionists and loyalists that the protocol could be got rid of, and that they would take unilateral action to do so. Their room for manoeuvre is really quite limited. I think it's probably best to dial down the rhetoric, which they have been doing, to be fair, for the last few weeks.
Even with David Frost at the helm?
Even, yeah. I think certainly he, when he started, he certainly dialed it up, but he seems to have dialed it down a bit. If, as James was suggesting in the Times on Friday, if actually they do start upping the ante again, I think it will be counterproductive. And I think they won't be able to rely on the Irish to help, because the more Britain appears to behave unreasonably, the more difficult it is for Ireland to come to their assistance.
James, Boris Johnson signed up to the protocol. We've covered that many times in previous podcasts. But yet, in Northern Ireland, I think, is it fair to say he's increasingly seen as a divisive figure, even if over here he isn't getting too much heat for that?
Divisive would imply that there were people in Northern Ireland who were defending him. No, look, unionism, when unionism feels it can't trust the British government, it goes into an angry and almost paranoid place. And I think you're seeing that at the moment. And I think that, you know, various people say, oh, Boris Johnson should spend more time in Northern Ireland. I'm not entirely sure that his reassurance about Northern Ireland's constitutional position works, because people feel that he said no border and then he agreed to half a border. And I think that is the problem. I think that this is the issue. The issue is that reassurance from the British government doesn't carry the same weight with the unionist community. I mean, the unionist community has always been suspicious of the British government, let's be honest. But it is particularly suspicious and particularly concerned about it at the moment. I think Dennis is right. The protocol isn't going to go away. And I think everyone accepts that. There is a big question about how it's implemented. Already, the checks on GB to NI are equivalent to 20% of all the checks carried out in the EU. And that's with the grace periods. And so the mind does boggle at how many checks are going to be carried out if the grace periods were to go. The protocol was always about trying to do this, to square the circle of how do you protect the Good Friday Agreement and the belief that that meant there couldn't be a border on the island of Ireland and protect the integrity of a single market. I think you've got to have more of an at-risk-based approach to the checks. And I think that means saying that if you know what the end user is of the good that is being shipped from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, it doesn't need to be checked. So, for example, if there are medicines being shipped to an NHS hospital, you don't need to check them because you know where they're going and they are unlikely to end up going over the border. In the same way, I think if you had 50 cars going to a car showroom in a particular place, you know the end location. That's that. The UK could help reassure the EU by passing laws that would impose huge fines, penalties, jail sentences for anyone who moved one of those goods over the border when they're not meant to be. But I think if the protocol has already brought down someone who in relative terms, in DUP terms, is a moderate, are you really going to carry on tightening the screw with the risk that you get the unionists reject the protocol, and then when told the protocol is necessary for the Good Friday Agreement, end up rejecting the Good Friday Agreement because that's what caused the protocol? And I think the final thing you need to knock on the head is the unionist worry is that this is all a Trojan horse to create economic unity between the North and the Republic ahead of political unity. I think if the checks were more on a risk base, that would show that that was not the aim.
I think for the European Union to agree something like that, first of all, it goes against the grain because they're so rules-based and law-based. But still, I think that, you know, insofar as they've been prepared to mess around with things, it's been on the basis of mutual trust. That's obviously been, you know, at a bit of a premium. I think, though, to go back to Arlene Foster was initially willing to try to make the protocol work. Edwin Poots, who is the likely next leader of the DUP and who is characterised as a hardliner, was also initially implementing the protocol. And Edwin Poots is somebody who has, in his dealings with Sinn Féin, he's been very pragmatic in his dealings with Dublin. He's a figure who doesn't play very well here, and because he has these very conservative Christian beliefs, which are unusual in modern Britain, but not quite so unusual in Northern Ireland, and I think are as deserving of respect as anybody else's. I think they don't necessarily have any great impact on public policy because there is no possibility of the DUP getting a majority in the Assembly for any of their anti-LGBT or anti-women legislation if they wanted to. And so, for example, that motion on banning gay conversion therapy, that was passed by the Assembly by 59 votes to 24. So Arlene Foster could have voted for it a number of times and still it would have passed. So I think in a way, if it's clear to unionists that the British government accepts that the protocol has to be made to work, the European Union is trying to make it work, then I think that unionists, including under the leadership of someone like Edwin Poots, could be willing to make this solution work. And I think that's something that It's the best solution. It's probably the only thing that we can hope for, really, in the current circumstances.
And finally, Dennis, you've recently been touring the United Kingdom as it currently sits, looking at the union issues, and they're not just confined to the Northern Ireland. Can you tell us a bit about your travels? Because you met with Nicola Sturgeon the other day.
I met Nicola Sturgeon the other day, and I asked her about the border between England and Scotland and how the Northern Ireland Protocol might be a model for how this could be worked. Because obviously the protocol was partly, it does actually introduce some easements to the passage of trade, the movement of trade. So for example, if you're sending something from Great Britain to Belfast, it's easier than sending it from Great Britain to Dublin because of the protocol. So she said that actually it could be a template for the UK-Scotland border. And that's something which didn't go down necessarily all that well in Scotland because the protocol hasn't got such a great reputation. So she's obviously hoping to get this overall majority in Scotland. It looks like touch and go as to whether she's going to. She insisted that obviously if there is a majority in the Holyrood Parliament to go for independence and a referendum, they should have one. Before that, I was in Wales and I was looking at the independence movement in Wales, which is very little discussed, but is actually growing to the point where support for it fairly consistently now is in the early to mid-20s. If you take out the don't knows, it goes above 30%. And it's at the kind of level that independence for Scotland was at before the Scottish referendum in 2014, just a couple of years before that. So the independence movement has now changed. There are a lot of new, younger people in there. And instead of just relying on Plaid Cymru, they're trying essentially to colonise parts of Welsh Labour, many of whom are either supportive of independence or at least curious about it. And there are increasing doubts in Wales about the current constitutional settlement because of things like the Internal Market Act and this kind of neo-unionist approach that the British government is taking, which appears to want to circumvent or undermine devolution.
And James, in this week's magazine, you say of all the threats that Dennis has just outlined, it's Scotland, which is, I suppose, the most imminent or the gravest.
I think the danger in Wales for the union is that the debate is polarising. Dennis is talking about support for independence, but support for abolishing the Welsh Assembly is at roughly the same level as support for independence. I think the danger is that you remove the middle ground, that you get to a kind of either let's get rid of the Assembly, go back to Wales simply sending MPs to Westminster and that's it, or independence. I think on Scotland, I think obviously we wait for the result of the election next week. I think Nicola Sturgeon's comments to Dennis were a rare misstep by her, because what they highlight is how difficult this issue of the border between Scotland and our UK will be. There's a first immediate practical problem raised by her comments to Dennis, which is Northern Ireland to GB is a sea border, so goods come in at ports. Scotland is a land border, so how would a protocol-style arrangement work on a land border? It's very hard to see how it would. The next problem is that Scotland wishes to be part of the European Union, part of a single market and the customs union. Northern Ireland, when it comes to trade with Great Britain, isn't part of a single market and the customs union. It's part of the UK customs union. Is she really suggesting that the EU would allow this? I think that's dubious. I also think that, given the fact, as Dennis said, that lots of EU countries already think that the Northern Ireland Protocol is too leaky, has too many concessions in it, I would be very surprised if the French, for example, were enthusiastic about Protocol 2. And I think the other problem is, as she identifies what the border looks like, I think, and maybe this is delusional, but I think that support for independence will begin to ease off. I think there is an interesting element going on here, which is if you look at the polling, and the trend, it's not radical, but the trend is a fall in support for independence. And I was talking to one veteran of Scottish politics about this week, and they said there's almost an element that when the electorate think that there's not going to be a referendum anytime soon, they're quite keen to say, oh yeah, we're in favour of independence. When they're told there's a referendum on independence tomorrow, how would you vote? Some hesitation kicks in. I think Nicola Sturgeon, who is such an accomplished media performer, if you look at her performance in interviews in this campaign, she clearly cannot answer the questions because they don't have an answer, frankly, on the currency and the border. And I think until they can get a better answer there, then I think the unionist side can have some consolation. I think if we rewound to these discussions that you and I had, Katie, about 6 months ago, unionists were deeply, deeply pessimistic. I think there is now more of a sense that even if you ended up in a situation where there had to be a second independence referendum, that there is more confidence about how it could be won. And I think one of the factors for this is that this campaign has finally seen the unionist side get a popular centre-left politician who isn't Gordon Brown. You look at Anas Sarwar's ratings, they're getting close to Nicola Sturgeon. I mean, that is the big boon for unionism from this campaign.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Dennis. And thank you for listening. And while we're here, yes, you guessed it, we have a Spectator app. You should definitely check it out. If enough people check it out, we'll stop saying this on the podcast, perhaps. But we also have a Spectator offer of 3 months for free on the website. And that is if you sign up now and you just go to spectator.co.uk/app offer. And that offer expires on Sunday.